Accession number 28776, Reel 22.
Admiral Raymond Lygott, Reel 22.
The desire to, well, not the desire, but the need to get rid of these sites in the south and concentrate was overwhelming in its logic. Because at this time, real estate values were beginning to be suddenly realized as something very important. And it was about this time that Royal Ordnance came on the market. And my board, as usual, were a bit... Well, the first thing I bought on national privatization, of course, was Sperry. I bought Sperry, and I made a big mistake. I left the management in situ. And the management of Sperry was no better than the management of British Aerospace, but they hadn't got anybody at the top to drive it. We bought Sperry. Let me tell you another little kind of political shenanigan. At that time, industry was divided up, and you could only work or bid for work in certain aspects of the requirement. So engines were, you know, Rolls-Royce was in that, and so was Bristol. But when it came to weapons, we were allowed to make weapons but not design the guts of the weapon, the guidance systems. That was done by Marconi. Underwater, we had been making it sonars. Now we were no longer able to make sonars because we were not streamed to be in underwater work. And so we couldn't be in it. When we bought Sperry, they had some very clever minds. Very clever minds. But, and we thought, right, we buy Sperry. We've now entered this different area of operation. And we'd hardly bought the bloody place before the Ministry of Defence changed their policy and said now everybody can bid for everything. So, you know, we had been totally misled. That decision had been taken by the Rayner Committee years before that said there wasn't enough scientific effort in this country to be wasted for everybody bidding for everything. So why not stream it? And that was the origin. But this was thrown away. Anyway, mine warfare was... An American Defense Committee came over from Washington to tour around the place, and I had a breakfast meeting with them all. And we were talking about, and this one of the chairman said to me, "Now, Sir Raymond, what is the easiest way of dealing with the Russian Navy?" And I said, "Mine them in." And he said, "What?" And I said, "Well, they're all trapped in narrow outlets to the sea. And the answer is to mine them in. Lay mines. We've got some very sophisticated mine, and that will be it." And he said, "Well, why haven't we done that?" Then I made one of my, I think, classic lager remarks. I said, "Because you can't give a cocktail party on a mine." And they all, "What do you mean by that?" I said, "Well, there is no, it's not a sexy activity, you see, and nobody wants to fund it. It's not." Anyway, mining was never a top priority, and so Sperry's was a bit of a disaster, and we had to set it eventually, combine it with other businesses at Bristol, etc. And fortunately, the real estate value then of the site compensated me, so I wasn't showing a loss. The next thing up for sale was Royal Ordnance, and after a lot of... typical kind of buggering about by the British Aerospace Board, I was allowed to go and bid for it. So we did. I went at top of the top range I was allowed, and we got it. And I won't bore you with the details, but we got it. Now, the next thing that happened, of course, was that we'd acquired two of the biggest sites they had in North London, Enfield and Waltham Abbey, and the value of these sites in terms of building land was tremendous. And some clever journalist got hold of the idea that we'd brought Royal Ordnance for whatever it was, 154 million or whatever it was, And the value of the real estate alone was worth, you know, and say we'd ripped off the government. Well, now, the first thing to remember was it was open tender. So anybody could have done this if they wanted to. But, of course, to take the area of Enfield and Waltham Abbey in acreage and say building land in London is worth so much an acre, this land was all poisoned. It had all been used for manufacturing armaments and had to be cleaned and, you know, allowed to lie for... So it really was a bit of a... But nevertheless, we were, on the one hand, saying, you know, Lygo is very clever, he's done a very clever deal here, but he's ripped off the government, which of course wasn't true, and wasn't doing us any good with the government. And, but they knew this as well as we did, but of course it didn't probably affect their backbenchers and all the rest of it, because it, the news is, sometimes takes a little time to percolate down. But we bought it and we then proceeded. I did not make the mistake I'd made with Spessy. I put in Dr. Maurice Dixon in as the managing director and told him to sort it out. And I remember him saying, let me show you a picture of the organisation of Royal Ordnance before we bought it. And it looked like Clapham Junction. And he said, this is what I've now done and I'm doing to sort it all out. And he did. But, so Royal Ordnance was fine. Commercial aircraft was still a problem. The British Aerospace 146 was a liability. And one can argue we should have closed it down. The board wanted me to close down the line, pack it all in, and I pointed out that at that time it would cost us something like $300 million, and we'd have the ongoing liability of the aircraft we'd already sold. So it didn't seem to be a sensible thing to do. I did say that I would shut Scottish Aviation up in Scotland, which was making
Pioneer? Is it the Pioneer they did?
Pioneer. Something 21. Anyway, come to me in a minute. It was a commuter airplane with 20... it had 19 seats. And under American law, at that time, you had to have a stewardess in anything over 19 seats. So it had 19 seats. It didn't have to have a stewardess. It had a stand-up loo and a stand-up corridor, so a passageway. So it suddenly became a Jetstream 31, Jetstream. But I had to go and see then the Secretary of State for Scotland to say, I'm very sorry, we're closing Prestwick. And he said, oh, well, right, it's the only manufacturing facility in Scotland. I said, yes, I know that, and I'm terribly sorry, but it's losing money, and I cannot keep it open. So he said, but you've had a government grant at some stage. I said, I know, it was $500,000, you can have it back. I said, but we're closing Prestwick. So I then sent a different chap up there to run Prestwick, and by golly, within 3 months, what we needed to sell 13 jet streams a year to break even, and suddenly we were up to 22, 24. The order book went mad, and so I didn't close Prestwick because it was now profitable and making money. What I didn't realise at the time, and what subsequently almost brought British Aerospace down after I left, was the fact that what he was doing was selling these. Now, let's start from the beginning. Douglas, in those days, in order to survive in business, making commercial aircraft, started what was known as sale and turnback. In other words, you bought or leased this aeroplane from them. It was a sale. But under the contract, you could turn that aircraft back to the company within 30 days or no notice if you didn't want it. Now, of course, it was madness, but once it was established, all manufacturers had to comply with it. So all these aeroplanes, not all, but most, were being sold on this turnback thing. Now, that was the way it was, but we were beginning to make book money on these aircraft before I left. But, of course, it was a struggle, and we had to, can you believe, for the first time, properly introduce just-in-time techniques. I remember going through, it may have been your father's factory at Chatterton, where we were then producing a second line of the 146, because I wanted to shut down Hatfield, so I wanted to get a second line going. When I walked through it, I saw engines sitting there. I said, what are these doing here? Oh, he said, these are engines. That was a military procurement attitude. You had to produce, you were going to produce 20 aeroplanes that year or whatever, so we'll produce, in their case, they kept the 146, 80 engines, all of which will be sitting there, not doing anything, but paid for. And so I said, well, get rid of all this lot, and we'll just, the engines will be fitted at the last minute. Even the undercarriage will be fitted at the last minute. It'll go down the line on a trolley. Everything that's expensive and bought in will be provided just in time. And so that was a revolution. But it was overdue for coming into effect. But it's over the civil aircraft was a struggle. And after I left, of course, I should say that just after privatisation, I wrote a strategy for British Aerospace, looking at the future, in which I said that we were in the business of manufacturing highly profitable, in a way, military products for the services, but this was in the midst of the Cold War, remember, should peace break out, we were going to be in, or could be in trouble. So what were we to do? And I said, well, we'll build up our space business, build up our civil aircraft business, and diversify into the more profitable parts of manufacturing. Because final assembly is not profitable. It's making the bits and pieces that is the most profitable. So that was the policy endorsed by the board. But of course, what we never envisaged at that time, when the Cold War ended, not only did the Cold War end and put a question mark over military procurement, the civil aircraft market collapsed at the same time. And that, I had now retired, but that left British Aerospace with a very difficult set of problems. But they weren't there when I was there, but they happened. And the finance director was fired after I left. The chairman was fired. Well, he had to step down. And not only for that reason, for other reasons, but it was a difficult time. But they weathered that storm. And now, as strong as ever, or stronger than ever, really.
In your time, what was the major overseas seller? Was it the military aircraft division?
Of course, the Alyumama was the saving grace, because that was the biggest contract in history. I suspect still is. The trouble it was when we got it, that we didn't know how to... It was very difficult to explain to analysts that we had this massive contract with the Saudis allowing us to say how big it was. And so you had to say, well, we've had this contract and it's going to be... and Alyumama was an enormous contract, but of course it was paid for in oil, and I remember very well, I think it was oil at $18 a barrel. Can you imagine that now? But anyway, it wasn't a massive contract, and it generated enormous profits for the company, and it also meant that we kept the production lines for the Tornado open, and we had a major overseas customer. At about this time, or just after this, we had a change of chairman. Tim Pearce retired, and in came Professor Roland Smith, who was a larger-than-life character, and his idea of running things was to find out where the best bargains were and go out and try and buy them. He had been a great supporter of mine. He just arrived when we bought Royal Ordnance. And the next one up, he suddenly announced to me, was what I've been told, that we could acquire Rover if we wanted to buy it. And I was then going on a visit to the Far East, and I went off and I was having these things. I said, well, I don't know whether this can work. And he said, well, I won't do anything until you come back, Ray. I won't do anything until you come back. But, oh, it's always a grand, oh, it's a grand offer. Oh, we'll make millions. $850 million they're going to give us to take it away. Well, when I came back, I said, I looked at it all and I said, well, I don't know. I said, if we'd have to give an undertaking to keep it for 5 years. The end of 5 years, then we should sell it, because I just don't think we can make it work. It's too expensive. Anyway, but I said, first of all, I must find out. I must talk to the chap that's now running it, and so he came over to see me in London in our house there, and I asked him if he would stay. That was Graham somebody. And he said he would. I said, in some way, shape or form, he said, I can do that. And he agreed to stay as a kind of non-executive director. I brought back a chap called Simpson, who was then running DAF, or was running part of DAF, which British Leyland, or British Motor, what they call themselves, Rover, then had an interest in. So he brought him back to run the day-to-day running of Rover, and he subsequently, after I'd left, left when they bought Marconi. He became part of Marconi, started to run Marconi, and then decided, after they'd bought it, they bought what British Airspace bought for the whole military business. He kept the remainder, and the remainder was a disaster. And so it very nearly bankrupt the company. But anyway, that's all in passing. But Rover was a particularly difficult one to justify. And of course we didn't get, and I told Roland Smith, you won't get $850 million. And he said, oh, I've been told I will. And I said, yes, but they won't be able to deliver. So he said, how do you mean? I said, well, you're shaking hands with a politician, and it'll have to be approved by Brussels, and they'll want all kinds of things about competitive and arrangements. And I said, we have to decide what is the figure at which we'll walk away. And that figure, according to me, was $650 million. And sure enough, at the end of the day, that's where we came down to. and so we just were able, with some last-minute hitches, because I was at a luncheon party in Downing Street, given by the Prime Minister, and who was there but the chap who was then Lord, I think he was Lord, wasn't he, by then? What was his name? Who was then the head of the Department of Trade and Industry, whose brief was to sell everything you can lay hands on. And so he had sold one of the government's biggest headaches, which was Rover. And I was there, and he was there, and talking about it. He was going to make a statement in the House of Lords that afternoon. And I suddenly had a call, just before I was going to lunch, from the finance director saying, well, the secretary, I think it was, doesn't matter, said, Ray, we're going to have to pull the purchase. I said, why? He said, because we've just had the terms and conditions that Brussels has imposed, and those are that we're not to change anything in the company for the whole time we are obliged to hold it five. I said, we can't possibly sign that. And they said, no, of course we can't. We're not going to, and we therefore told them we can't sign the contract. So I said, well, I'm here with whatever his name was. And I said, they said, oh, well, don't tell him. I said, I can't not tell him. I mean, the chap is, I've just been talking to him. So I went back in and said, I'm terribly sorry about it. I think we've got a problem. And he then was shattered, and we were all shattered, I think. And for 24 hours, the whole thing had to be on hold until Brussels had to understand that no private company, no company, could possibly commit itself to not changing anything, because what did we know we were going to find? And so they had to be modified. And so the sale went ahead. And I had to clean up some various bits and pieces at the end. which was the fact that we weren't going to have to, we were going to get the $650 million up front. That was right. And it wasn't a loan, it was a gift. And what else was interesting there? I think we were then arguing with the trade and, well, no, not trade and industry, the VAT people, government tax people, about our taxable liability on our involvement in Airbus. And once the tax inspector had said, right, you're all right, you don't, you're not be liable, and we'd been carrying, therefore, something like 13 or 40 million contingent liability in the balance sheet. And then the tax inspector changed. The new one said, oh, no, I think I'm going to look at this again. And, oh, my God. So I had to say to them, look, please. So that was looked at. I had to get the Ministry of Defence and the Trade and Industry to look at various bits and pieces which we were owed and have been outstanding for some time to get those payments expedited. So they were. And afterwards, I believe, after I'd left, there was some big argument about whether all this was legal. Well, legal or not legal. The fact is, they owed us the blooming money. We just got it a bit earlier than we might otherwise have got it. But that was just good business acumen. So British Airspace was an interesting experience, and I finished at the end of it. I would have liked to have gone on to be chairman, but that was not to be. They had Roland Smith in, but he didn't last. And then I left. I said to him, well, I'm leaving, and I spent 36 years in a disciplined service where loyalty was taken for granted. Once I've gone, you can't rely on it. And within 2 years, he'd gone too. And it was a bit of a messy affair, I'm sure. But there you are. That was it. And another life beckoned. And so I was off to James Capel's as a non-executive director and at Rutland Trust and various other things that kept me busy right up until my 80th year. So when we hear about people having to work a little longer, I think, well, hang about. I mean, it seems to me that if you can work, it's better for you to work than to sit and just go all kind of flabby and useless. So there we go. Message is.